Hey listeners, this episode of Covert features descriptions of violence and torture. Listener discretion is advised. February 27th, 1959. A cruise liner, the MS Berlin, was docked on the shore of Havana, Cuba. The island had just undergone a massive political revolution, but to the people on board the luxury ship, the visit was just part of their transatlantic vacation.
Havana was the last stop on a monthly cruise that the MS Berlin would take. And wealthy, mostly German people who wanted to get away, snowbirds.
The captain's daughter, 19-year-old Marita Lorenz, was on the deck watching some sort of celebration. The young mariner didn't have a formal education, but learned working with her father at sea from the many places they traveled. She was especially fond of Havana.
Because I loved Havana. I loved the Coco Glacé. I loved the music, the people, the temple. I cared nothing about politics. Politics, nothing. There's palm trees, islands, currents, stars, the moon, Neptune. That was my life.
As Marita looked out onto the bay, a small boat approached the cruise liner.
Anyway, I saw this launch coming from the bay, and it was coming closer and closer and closer. And then finally, they stood up and waved. And I saw that they all had guns, all wore green uniforms and had beards. And I said, oh, wow, that's the new army that my papa told me about.
At the bow of the incoming vessel stood a tall man, bearded, and with a cigar. He was looking directly towards Marita.
And he just, like, without asking, you know, just held on to the railing, and he waved. He looked up, and I looked down, and he was the taller one, with a rifle and arms, and they all had uniforms and sidearms, and he said, I'm coming up. I said, no. And he said, yes. You know, and I said, well, who are you? And he said, you don't know who I am? I, no. And I said, I'm the captain's daughter. And I said, no. He said, but yes, you are in my waters. But if you step on the ladder, you're on my ship. So that's the way it went. It was teasing. I was goofing. And He just didn't ignore me. He just came aboard. I just laughed at him. I said, you did it. You just came, you just violated the international laws of the sea.
Unbeknownst to Marita, she was flirting with Fidel Castro. And in doing so, she would change the entire course of her life.
Here you have one of the prime targets by the U.S. government and the CIA. So anybody that's accompanying him, around him, or anywhere connected with him is going to be known in detail by U.S. intelligence.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations.
But once the United States made a decision that Castro needed to be removed from power, the United States started supporting people who they believed they had a chance of going back into Cuba and overthrowing him. But by the summer, the die was cast. They knew that something had to happen, that Castro had to be removed.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special operations missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to eliminate threats and protect innocent lives.
He was a bad guy. He was affiliated with the Russians. He hadn't told her any of that information. She didn't know any of that. So he wasn't the person that she thought he was.
But sometimes, in getting their missions accomplished, take it too far.
A needle in my arm, and the pain was unbearable, and I felt wet. And just somebody working over my body and being half conscious and half not. Not there at all. The pain was incredible, and I was moaning. All of a sudden, I saw the cowboy hat, and it was Camilo Cienfuegos. And he was saying, "Ay, Dios mío, coño carajo." And he was cursing and said, "What happened to you? What happened to you?" And I said, "Where's the baby? Where's the baby?"
This is the story of how a young woman's life was turned upside down in a whirlwind romance with an infamous dictator, and how her life was turned around once again by the CIA as they saw an opportunity to get rid of Castro. This is The Castro Assassin, Part 1. You can really tell when somebody actually knows what they're talking about. When they talk confidently and intelligently about a subject, you know that they're telling you the truth because they just have this sense about them. I really recommend checking out History's Greatest Military Blunders and the Lessons That They Teach. It's one of the courses that's featured on the Great Courses Plus app, and it's really in-depth and it's really awesome, and you get to learn about the stuff like the embarrassments of Napoleon. I mean, really? Moscow? Winter? Shorts? Folks? Come on. And this is not just a lecture. This comes complete with battle plans and animations and historical maps. It really gives you a sense of what was going on. It's very in-depth and it's very detailed. So what I've done is I've worked out this really fantastic limited time offer for my listeners, okay? You're going to get a full month for free, no obligation, an entire month to test everything out, go through, drain all the courses that you want for a month for free. But you got to sign up today and you have to use my special URL. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/covert, and covert is important, so don't forget that. thegreatcoursesplus.com/covert. A month earlier, an open-top Cadillac was driving slowly through the cobbled streets of Havana. Men, women, and children stood on either side of the road, cheering in celebration. Inside the car, still in his green fatigues, sat the young revolutionary new leader, Fidel Castro. For many Cubans, Castro was a heroic liberator. He forced former right-wing dictator Fulgencio Batista into exile and brought about a new socialist form of government to the island nation.
When he won power on New Year's Day in 1959, he was the hero of the Cuban population. If there had been elections in January or February of 1959, he might easily have won 90% or more than 90% of the vote.
That's Dr. Brian Littell, the author of After Fidel. He spent over three decades working for the CIA and advised the White House on political developments in Latin America.
His popularity was comparable in many parts of Latin America. He was seen as a conquering hero. He was seen as a romantic man. He was 32 years old, and there was an appeal, the beard and the costume that he cultivated very, very carefully, and he's almost never being seen out of that guerrilla costume. He was admired in much of Latin America, especially among the youth, the university students, the nationalists, and of course the left, the radical left, and many on the democratic left looked to Castro as a role model for their own countries.
But the young Marita didn't know any of this about the man now boarding her ship, just that he was funny and very handsome.
And I saw his eyes, and that was it. I fell in love. I said, "Oh my God, I've never had a boyfriend." I just looked at his smile, and he stared until the last step, until he came onto the ship. And I shook hands. I said, "Welcome to Germany. Welcome to the Berlin. And I don't know what to do with you." And I said, "The first thing, you don't need guns here. We don't allow guns. So take them off." And he just looked at me like, "What? Wow. You take off my guns? No, nunca. No, nunca, no, no, me quita nada. I'm taking off nothing." And I said, "What should I do with you?" And he said, "Show me the ship." I said, "Okay, we start at the engine."
Marita led the revolutionaries on a tour of the ship, starting with the engine room. Castro was joined by his leaders, Camilo Cienfuegos and Che Guevara, all still dressed in military clothes. When the elevator doors opened to reveal the soldiers, the crew were understandably shocked.
The personnel looking at me like, my God, she's brought an army on board, you know, and he put his hand on top of mine. And I said, now you have the engine room. And then I led him through most of the ship, the staterooms, and we ended up in the Florida bar, alligator bar.
Marita's father, the captain, was sleeping to prepare for an early morning departure. The group waited at the bar, hanging out until he was due to wake up.
Sit, I said, we have to wait till 3 o'clock. And he said, I have time, day, and night, and forever. I can wait. He wore two watches. It just didn't make any sense. I said, why two? He said, because the time doesn't mean anything to me. And before I knew it, the first officer was coming down to get me, to take me up to my father. And then I said, just make it good. So don't tell him not to be mad. He's only visiting. He's not taking over. And I said, well, I told him this is German soil, so he won't do anything. He'll listen to me. He'll be all right. And we had a little beer, Beck's beer, and little crumpets. And he held my hand under the table. I was lost. He wrote on a napkin, te quiero mucho. And I wrote, I had a phone number in New York, but I gave him the phone number on a napkin. And then my father stormed in, and immediately I pulled my hand away so he wouldn't, Papa wouldn't see. And he just looked at me, and Fidel stood up, and he said, Comandante, this is Comandante Fidel Castro Ruth. And he knew right away this was Fidel, and all right, let me make friends with him. You know, I don't want him on the bad side. And he said, welcome aboard. And we had dinner together in the dining room, three-course meals, and small conversation.
Marita was absolutely smitten.
Walked by casually just to make sure that he didn't forget I was here. And looking back and forth, and he couldn't stop looking at me, and I think my father caught that. Then he said, well, your daughter could be my secretary. She speaks German. I get a lot of letters. I have a lot of mail I have to attend to. Right now I'm living in the Havana Hilton. Fidel asked Papa if he would stay and be his tourist minister. He would make him a minister of tourism. Absolutely not. My father said, no, she's going to school.
After her father bid them all good night, she went to see the soldiers off their ship. As he left, she said, Castro turned to her.
Dark was a beautiful night, moonlit night, full moon. It was just an absolute beautiful night. He caught me going on the deck, and he caught me between my life, the lifeboats, when we were all leaving the captain's quarters, the bridge upstairs. And pulled me between the lifeboats and hugged me. And he said, I want you to be my secretary. And that's the first time I kissed him. And my father didn't see. He went down the steps. He kept looking back. He tripped once, kept looking back. And Papa was getting, you know, ready to leave, like, hurry up, get off the ship so he can pull up the stairs. And I waved. And he just smiled. He smiled, yo te quiero, whispered, you know.
Marita didn't want to leave Cuba, but the ship was set to depart back to New York.
One more day in Cuba. One more day, I'll learn about his new government. I didn't think of revolutions or anything. And I wasn't afraid of them. And I remember standing on the top deck when we pulled out of the harbor and looking at the moon and the outline of Havana, the beautiful white buildings and the Malecón drives, and missing him and feeling terrible. I've got to see him again. This, I've never had a boyfriend, and I want to see him again. I don't care who he is, I just want to see him. He could have been a mechanic working in a garage. I still would have fallen in love with him. And that was my first love.
The ship went on its regular course, and Marita returned to her regular life. At the time, she was staying with her older brother, Joe, who worked as a translator at the UN. But she didn't want to go to school like she was supposed to. Something had changed.
I didn't want to go to school, and I just hung around and cooking and ironing my brother's shirts. And I was reading the article by Herbert L. Matthews on the New York Times. Fidel Castro, rebel, Cuba. I was reading that. I said, I just met him. I was reading that, and I was making jello. And the phone rang, and it was Fidel. That was that. That was that. I said, it's really you. Yes, yes. I hadn't even unpacked. I had a feeling that somehow I'm going to jump ship somewhere and go back there and see him. But he said, how are you? I miss you. And with his bad English, asked me to come back. I send you airplane.
Her brother, busy with work, and her father back in Germany with the ship, Marita set off to Havana without anyone in her family knowing. But before she left behind a small clue to her whereabouts.
And here I was, sticking a pin in a wall map, a red little push pin into Havana to let my brother know that maybe he'll catch on. You know, my brother was too busy with his girlfriends and the UN. And that was my signal that I was back in Havana. Because putting a pin in Havana in the map on the wall.
As promised, Castro did send a plane. An aide showed up at the apartment to drive Marita to the airport. She had only a suitcase and a passport and found herself the only passenger on the plane. Cuba was not a wealthy island, but the new leader was clearly allowing himself some luxury. For Marita, it was a fairy tale.
Oh, in his plane, I was the only one on the plane other than the stewardess, and everybody was speaking pure Spanish, and I just was flabbergasted that there were no other passengers. So I just picked up a magazine. One of the stewardesses handed me the Bohemia magazine with Fidel on the cover of the magazine. And I felt absolutely terrified, happy, frustrated, oh my God, and defying my parents without telling them. I felt very guilty. And I figured, well, I'll just go for a week or two and then come back. And when I saw the outline of the island, oh my God, and the harbor with no ship in it, and the Hilton, and I knew he was there in the Hilton Hotel. And everything was just automatic. The men around me were like, I was circled with a group of bodyguards and pelletier. And I said, where am I going? And nobody answered me or anything. And to see El Comandante, he said, and that's it. And I drove me by Jeep to the Hilton. And then through the lobby, and everybody's looking, who is she? You know, actors and a lot of people, a baseball team waiting to see Fidel, and thousands of people waiting. And here I go right through with the aides.
Marita was joined by Shay and Camilo, as well as Celia Sanchez, Castro's secretary. Together, they went straight to the 24th floor of the Hilton to a suite. This would be Marita's home for however long she stayed in Cuba.
Celia Sanchez, his secretary, and she's the first one that welcomed me up there into the suite. Make yourself at home. Beautiful suite with flowing curtains and the tropical smells, and the first thing I remember, the smell of cigars. This is his place. I look around, and there's all his uniforms under plastic, boots turned upside down, and ashtrays with cigars in it, and this beautiful music, Piano Magico, the rumba beat, and it was a record that never stopped. It played over and over and over again. And then I see toys, little tanks, and mail and fan mail, and a big picture somebody painted of himself, of Fidel, and then a bazooka sticking out from under the bed. All of a sudden, I hear the door swing open and the smell of cigars, and he came in and picked me up and swung me around, and I miss you so much, you know, and love talk, and that's a moment I'll never forget. We ended up in bed.
Castro took Marita on a few tours of Havana, pointing out the poverty he was determined to get rid of. Especially pressing was the infrastructure that had fallen to ruin during Batista's regime. Hospitals, schools, and roads were a mess. Castro said he was going to fix it all.
I'd ride along with him in a Jeep, and he said, "That's going to end." He would look at a little boy selling souvenirs on the street, or his sister to some tourist, and it's going to end. I used to say, "No, you must have good hospitals." And he said, "No, you want to see hospital?" And he took me to one of Batista's hospitals. It was appalling.
Hey, listeners, the folks over at Junel Law Firm have contacted me, and they have a message for all of my active or retired military listeners. Were you diagnosed with tinnitus or hearing loss after using 3M's dual-ended earplugs? A lot of times these earplugs were yellow and black or yellow and olive, and they were called Christmas lights. But instead of protecting your hearing, they actually permitted some damaging sounds to get through. So, if you were issued these earplugs while you were in service, then diagnosed with tinnitus or hearing loss, I want you to call 1-800-400-1349, because you may qualify for significant cash compensation. Again, if you served in the military and you were issued 3M's dual-ended yellow and dark earplugs, and then you were later diagnosed with hearing loss or tinnitus, then I want you to call 800-400-1349 right now to see if you qualify for cash compensation. 3M knew of the defects, but failed to warn anyone about them. A whistleblower lawsuit that 3M quietly settled made the case that 3M manipulated test results to make it appear as if the earplugs met government standards, but they didn't. So, if you were in the military from any time between 2003 through 2015 and are suffering from diagnosed hearing loss or tinnitus, then please call 1-800-400-1349 right now. The lawsuit's against 3M and not the government or the military, so your benefits with the VA will not be affected. Again, 1-800-400-1349. Let's get back to it. Despite the celebration on the island, many around the world became concerned about this new leader. This was especially true in Washington, D.C. U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower asked his intelligence agencies to find out more about this Cuban revolutionary.
Eisenhower was a much older man. The hero of Normandy, the hero of the European war. And Fidel is this 32-year-old, bearded, khaki-clad revolutionary insisting on wearing the clothes that he wore as a guerrilla.
Mitch Weiss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and critically acclaimed author.
The fear for the United States was that a Cuban-style revolution would explode throughout Latin America, and that there would be more than one Cuba. There would be a Cuban-style regime in Venezuela, in Chile, in Peru, in Argentina. And that posed a real threat. One of Castro's goals was to export revolution throughout Central and South America. He really felt for the people he believed were being exploited in all those countries. So he wanted to train a group of Cubans to go from country to country to train people in those countries and basically overthrow those governments.
A large concern was that the island housed a few United States-owned businesses, including sugar mills and banks. If Castro really was the socialist they thought he was, it wouldn't be long before he nationalized most big businesses.
I think in early 1959, once Castro starts, you know, seizing and nationalizing some of the industries, we realize that, you know, Castro is really more of a socialist than a Democrat. And at that point, the United States was extremely worried. They made sure that the CIA was there trying to gather as much intelligence as possible. But when you read those reports, those now declassified documents at the time, there was debate between, you know, internal debate in the National Security Council, the CIA, just where Cuba was going. Was it becoming more of a Soviet country? Was it going to be a socialist country? How were things going to turn out? And you could tell that there was just really no clear consensus in the CIA, in the National Security, in the administration on how it was going to turn out. And there was some school of thought that maybe Eisenhower didn't spend as much time, his administration didn't spend as much time on trying to understand the key players in the Cuban Revolution. We were so focused on the Soviet Union, Communist China at the time. That's really where our intelligence was focused and based, that we didn't realize there was a threat right in the United States' backyard until it was too late and Castro had seized power. But again, once he started nationalizing some of the industries, the United States realized that we had to focus our attention because this had the potential to become a communist base in our hemisphere.
And Cuba is only 103 miles away from the American coast. Anything that starts there could easily branch out into the United States. In April 1959, Fidel Castro was invited to the U.S. by the Society of Newspaper Editors. Castro accepted the invitation, hoping to win over American public opinion as tensions between the two countries steadily rose.
In April of 1959, Fidel had come to the United States on an unofficial visit, but he came to America without the official sanction of a state visit. President Eisenhower, by now, was getting more impatient, more untrusting of the true nature of the Castro regime, because some of Eisenhower's advisors were warning him that there was a distinct communist tint to the revolution.
Marita was present at the visit, and so was the CIA. It was likely that this was where they first took notice of her. Kevin Shipp is a former CIA agent and can speak to how the CIA usually operates.
I would think it'd be a strong possibility that while Fidel was in the U.S., in New York with Marita, that would have been a prime opportunity for her to be spotted. Without question, it was a high-level meeting, and you can be sure that U.S. intelligence was all over that visit. So absolutely, that would have been, as I said, a very strong possibility.
I wanted to state very clear to the people of the United States that I came here with a sincere feeling of friendship, and because I wanted.
Castro started off his visit with a speech, working his charm on the public. All the while, the United States government was not too happy, and while his charisma made him appealing to the people, an attempt at diplomacy soon turned to a political faux pas.
And it was just not the kind of meeting that Eisenhower desired. Richard Nixon met with him, the acting Secretary of State met with him, many others met with him, many others in Washington, both in the media and in government.
I saw many newspapers, several newspapers, newspapermen, yes, some written that they was coming for money, and it was not the truth.
He was pushed off to Nixon, and Nixon immediately labeled him, you know, and probably was turned off by Fidel's beard and his cigar and his uniform. And I said to Fidel afterwards in the hotel, I said, you didn't come by invitation. You came by yourself because your ego is a little too big and you didn't wear a suit and a tie. And he got mad at me for saying that. That's the first time I saw him angry. In other words, it did sink in.
Brian says the meeting went well with Nixon, but Castro was looking forward to meeting with the president himself as one country's leader to another.
And instead, Eisenhower rejected him and pushed him off to Nixon, which absolutely infuriated Fidel. He felt very set back and angry, very angry. That he was pushed aside, that he wouldn't even get a cup of coffee.
And on the American side, Eisenhower was beginning to recognize that Castro could be a serious emerging threat to the U.S.
It was just weeks after he won power. It was still in January 1959 when Fidel began very stridently attacking the United States in speeches. He did this in speech after speech. He denounced the United States. It was pretty soon after he won power that he also began to support violent incursions, interventions against other Latin American leaders. All of these initiatives, especially the stridency of his speeches against the United States, began to take a toll. And by the end of 1959, it was becoming more and more clear in the Eisenhower, in the councils, the highest councils of the Eisenhower administration, that the revolutionary government was really inimical to American interests, to American property interests, to Americans on the island, and to American interests in a number of other Latin American countries. And that's when covert policies, anti-Castro policies, began to coalesce. The anti-American speeches became quite frequent. They were strident. They were harsh.
Podrá contar el movimiento revolucionario en cualquier rincón de la tierra.
Back in Cuba, Marita learned to live day-to-day life as one of the prime minister's mistresses. She lived in the Havana Hilton, acting as his secretary, but otherwise doing very little.
I opened letters, and if they were from girls, I'd tear them up. Or if they were pictures, I'd mark up the pictures. If there were money, donations, all threw into one drawer. Or correspondence that I didn't understand into another drawer. That's all. He would come and go as he pleased and he wished. I had nowhere to go. He didn't want me outside. All I did really was wait.
But Marita was happy. She was enjoying life in Havana, and she was in love. And after a few months, she found herself pregnant.
I was happy to be pregnant, very happy. He was happy. He said, "Oh, wonderful. Half Cuban, half Alemana, half German, half Cuban," I said, "and American." And he was very happy. He said, "Now I have to build another hospital. I was going to build a woman's hospital." That's the very first thing he did too. He absolutely did do that.
Castro seemed just as happy as Marita and promised her that he would get her a private house to live in after the baby was born.
Getting big, getting ready for the baby. He said I could go to the store and get baby clothes, and we would furnish the baby's place in the house with my teachers. And in those days, he didn't have sonogram, you know. He didn't know if it was a boy or a girl, but I kind of knew it was a boy.
But politically, everything was not fine. Over the next few months, U.S.-Cuban relations deteriorated rapidly.
But once the United States made a decision that Castro needed to be removed from power, the United States started supporting people who believed they had a chance of going back into Cuba and overthrowing him. But by the summer, the die was cast. They knew that something had to happen, that Castro had to be removed.
Eisenhower, it seemed, wanted Castro assassinated, and it was up to the CIA to get the job done. But Castro's security was impossible to penetrate. What they needed was an inside man, someone who was already close to him. Former CIA agent Kevin Shipp called Castro a hard target.
Morita would have very close access to Fidel. Fidel, I'm sure, had very, very tight security. He would have bodyguards with him, protective detail wherever he went. He would have guards outside his apartment, and I'm sure just based on his MO, he's moving around, he's unpredictable. We would call that a hard target, someone that's very difficult to get to. In Morita's case, in terms of spotting someone with access, she had apparently a romantic relationship with him, which would get her past all the security. A romantic relationship would actually get him into his bedroom, and she would be able to bypass all of his security layers and his unpredictability, and really would have been a prime target for spotting and eventual recruitment.
Fidel Castro has always enjoyed, from the very beginning, he's enjoyed very, very good personal security. Very good. It's comparable to, to the best anywhere in the world.
Kevin believes Morita was a prime target for CIA recruitment. They had already put her past the first stage, spotting.
Well, in my opinion, they would have known everything. Here you have one of the prime targets by the U.S. government and the CIA. So anybody that's accompanying him, around him, or anywhere connected with him is going to be known in detail by U.S. intelligence.
The second step in recruitment was to find out everything they could about her. They would especially be looking for vulnerabilities or weaknesses they could use to turn her against Castro.
Well, that brings us to the next step in the recruitment cycle. It's called the developer development. And at that point, probably in the United States, they would approach Morita and begin developing her.
Morita was 7.5 months pregnant. She was alone in the Havana Hilton and had just ordered her room service breakfast.
And I had ordered breakfast, and I drank the milk, and I fell over on the bed. I felt dizzy. I said, well, maybe this is just because of the pregnancy, you know? But no, I was out. I was out. All I remember was falling backwards on the bed and looking up at the ceiling and going to sleep.
Morita's memory of what happened next is very hazy. All she knows was that she was in pain. There were flashes of images of people.
And then I woke up in a car, and I was being driven somewhere, and the water hit me in the face. The window was down in the car. I could taste the salt water, and I was moaning. I was like half asleep. And then I was out. I don't even remember who was driving, but there were other people in the car. And the next thing I remember is lights, a light above me, and terrible pain, and arguing back and forth, cursing in Spanish. And I don't know if my clothes were on or off, or somebody's moving my body back and forth, but I was like twilight. Half gone, half awake, and I thought the baby was born. For a moment, I thought the lights, it's premature baby delivery. I heard baby cry.
Something had happened to the baby. Of that, Morita was sure.
I had a needle in my arm, and the pain was unbearable, and I felt wet. And just somebody working over my body and being half conscious and half not there at all. The pain was incredible, and I was moaning. I remember my arm going up to hear the voice of the baby to stop the arguing, and I felt restrained immediately. Two arms holding my arms together, restrained, which I thought was unusual and made me frightened, and I started to cry, and that's all I remember.
She heard familiar voices as she came back into consciousness.
And cursing, I don't know if they're arguing at him or with him or against him or for him or what. I couldn't make it out. But Fidel will have you killed. Fidel will kill you, this or that, you know? And then I woke up again in bed, back in my suite. And all of a sudden I saw the cowboy hat, and it was Camilo Cienfuegos. And he was saying, "Ay, Dios mío, coño, carajo." And he was cursing. I said, "What happened to you? What happened to you?" And I said, "Where's the baby? Where's the baby?" And he said, "Get a towel and have somebody else to get a towel." And he packed me. I was bleeding to death. I said, "What happened?" And he said, "You had a baby." And I said, "Call my brother, call my mother, call my mother." I wanted my mother. He did call my brother and had me clean up and got me a doctor, gave me antibiotics. He said, "I have to get you out." I called Fidel. I can't find him. He's in Camagüey somewhere. And he did call my brother Joe in New York and said, "I'm sending your sister back. She has to go to the hospital immediately."
Camilo informed Marita's brother Joe that she was ill. Joe had no idea she was spending her days in Cuba. He thought she had been in school. He was even more shocked to find out she had been pregnant with Fidel Castro's child. But with Marita's life in danger, they knew she had to be taken to a modern hospital. One of Castro's aides arranged for her to fly back to New York for urgent medical treatment. And when she landed, the FBI agents were waiting for her.
The FBI met me at the airport, and I went straight to Roosevelt Hospital, and under FBI protection, surrounded by it.
Within hours, Marita was suddenly pulled out of her happy life in Cuba and into the unknown. Castro's aides and friends were replaced by mysterious FBI agents. Her baby was gone, and she was about to go through a grueling practice to turn her into a deadly assassin to kill the man she loved.
"Look, can you just put something in his food and put him to sleep?" And I said, "Are you trying to tell me to kill him?" And they said, "Well, we don't use those words. It's just kind of neutralizing him. You would never know, and you would leave." I said, "I can't kill him."
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And hey, if you've got some time, give us a review.